Hello and welcome to the latest exciting instalment of the Bad Wilf podcast. On this episode, I'm joined by writer extraordinaire James Moran. And let's just jump right into it. I'm now joined by James Moran. James, I'll start by asking the most important question you can in modern times. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. How are you?
All right. Dealing with this heat wave at the minute. I asked you on to talk about your novelization of The Fires of Pompeii. How did you get involved?
They just basically asked if I wanted to do it. I got a message. Was I interested? And obviously, yes, I was. I'd actually contacted them about a year beforehand because there was a new batch had just come out.
Sure.
And I just kind of got in touch through somebody. I can't remember how. I just kind of thought they do ask people before they hand these out, don't they? They wouldn't just like hand mine to someone without checking with me first, or just sort of assuming that I wasn't interested. So I was just like, I'm just gonna mention it and say that, you know, if it does happen at some point one day, then I am very much interested to keep me top of the list. It came around eventually, and then I was there.
That's good. What was the writing process like in adapting this from screen to book?
Lots of panicking, because I've never done a prose thing this long before. Yeah. I've never done a full book. I mean, they're not even big books. They're not even that huge, but it was way more than I'd done. So it was a bit of a just trying to get my head around that. And then it was basically just going through the script and sort of taking that and throwing it into a file and going through my early drafts, things that I'd left out, early outlines, things like that. There's lots of things that you cut out of a TV episode, not because there's anything wrong with them, but because it just slows things down. Yeah. So I guess there is something wrong with them because they're not moving things along quickly. But you can take a bit more time in a book. You can kind of slow things down and go off on tangents and just kind of go, right, I'm just gonna park the story for a minute and we're gonna explain something and have a little side story here. So it just gave it more room to breathe, which again, you know, in a 45 minute action packed TV show, yeah, is not really what you want to do too much of.
Were there any original ideas that had to get cut for time or whatever that you put into the book?
Yeah, there were a few sort of volcanic things that, like, you know, obviously you make a point once in a TV episode, you don't need to kind of go back and make it again in slightly different ways. So there were a couple of volcanic side effects that I wanted to get back in, because, you know, obviously visually when you see it on screen once, you don't need to go back over it. But in the novel, I think it just helps to give it a bit more of an atmosphere, a bit more sort of sinister background. I was doing lots of research and I found a really cool sound recording of tectonic plates grinding against each other. Wow. Underground, and they'd sped it up obviously because it's so slow. Yeah. you can't hear it, and it's just this really creepy noise. So I thought I've got to get that in somehow, and just things like that.
I have to look that up. That sounds really, really fascinating.
It's the creepiest sound in the world. It really is.
I bet it is. How did it feel to be back in the Doctor Who universe after so long away?
Oh, it was like riding a bike.
Yeah.
I haven't ridden a bike since I was a kid, so God knows what that would actually be like in real life. I would probably smash myself to pieces. It was like riding a bike in the event that I had any sort of physical coordination, which I... Yeah, it's just... I mean, they're characters that I know and love, and particularly just going back to write for Donna was an absolute joy. I mean, you can't go wrong with writing Donna dialogue. She's so funny. And then just getting to go into her head a little bit and go off on sort of tangents. Right, even right from the first page, I basically have sort of a page and a half of just her anxious brain just talking absolute nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very, very much able to tap into that sort of thing.
You got the pitch and tone of Donna down perfectly. Like I could hear Catherine Tate in my head as I was reading it. It's fantastic.
That's the advantage, is that, yeah, I've seen her perform the character, so I don't have to stop and think what she might say or how she might say it. It's like it's a gift that she's already in your head. You don't have to kind of...
Was that challenging first time round? I don't know if you'd seen her portrayed a character before?
Well, first time it wasn't going to be Donna. They were going to have a new character called Penny, but they kept saying, like, she's very much like Donna. She's got that same sort of attitude of Donna. And then eventually when they had finally sort of agreed to that they were going to cast her and it wasn't a secret anymore, they just said, okay, it is Donna. It just is Donna now. So I don't know if they were always going to go with Donna, or if Penny was like a secret cover name or something, but, or if they weren't, they were very much wanting to go in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I, it was, that was a relief because when we were trying to sort of, when I was trying to sort of plan the story and they were trying to sort of explain who the new character was going to be, it's difficult to get your head around someone who doesn't exist yet. But as soon as they said it was Donna, then that just made it a lot easier. Yeah. I rewatched The Runaway Bride and sort of realized that Donna's not really Donna until those sort of last 5 or 10 minutes. Mm. She doesn't become the Donna she is until then, because that fundamentally changes her and who she is and her approach. So that was sort of, because you can't have an entire series of a very, very angry, shouty Donna nonstop.
No.
I don't think that would really work. But it's the Donna she develops into after her collision with the Doctor and the Doctor's universe.
She's one of the most fascinating companions I think Doctor Who's ever had. Mm. And that must make her an absolute joy to write for, because she's multi-layered.
Yeah, completely. I mean, yeah, she's got the funny jokes and thing, but there's also just that sort of unwillingness to let the Doctor get away with anything, where, you know, things that might have let slip in the past.
Yeah.
Donna's just like, no, why are you doing that? That makes absolutely no sense. What are you talking about, you ridiculous stick insect?
I always saw her as the Doctor's younger sister, and like, she's the only one that could ever call him out.
Yeah, it's very much a brother and sister kind of, I hesitate to use the word banter before it got ruined. That sort of kind of bantery interplay and back and forth and just taking the mickey out of each other.
Yeah. What were the challenges involved in adapting this?
Oh, just that I'm so used to scripts.
Yeah.
And I'm not used to prose at all. I used to be a lot more used to it, because that's how I first started writing short stories. So It was very much a kind of an adjustment to go back to prose, especially when you're adapting a script and you've got the script in front of you. I had to do several passes where I had left things in the present tense, because you write scripts in the present tense.
Yeah.
It's very much he walks into the room, grabs the sonic screwdriver and you know, but you can't, obviously can't, you, well, you can do present tense in a book, but I was very much not doing that. So just trying to keep the tenses clear was tricky. The sort of the fear that knowing that right from the very first words, everyone is going to see these words, they're going to see these sentences. Like there's no hiding behind the script where they don't see the stage directions. They don't even see the script. They just hear the dialogue. And then there's this beautiful finished episode on screen that makes you look good. Whereas on this page, the only person who can make you look good or bad is you. There's nowhere to hide. That was quite scary. And yeah, and just trying not to think about the word count. That was, because that's a big, I mean, I've probably written scripts that have more words in, to be fair, but it's just a big number just hanging over your head. So trying to ignore that. Well, I'm just trying to figure out what to put in that wouldn't kind of slow it down too much.
Yeah.
And what needed to go back in and what didn't. And just, there were a few sort of serial elements from season 4 that I did actually, that were great in the episode, that I did take out, because there's no guarantee. They did say there's no guarantee that every single episode of every single series will be done. So it's kind of tricky to put in the serial stuff. So the things like she is returning and there's something on your back, couldn't really do that, because that may never get picked up in a book. Yeah. And even if it does get picked up in another book, somebody might just be reading this one book or a few books, and it's not a satisfying closed experience. Whereas with a TV show, you know you're watching the rest of the series.
Have you been bitten by the novelization bug now? Could we see you go and do like Cockneys versus Zombies or Severance?
Absolutely not. I've found it really, really difficult. Just because I'm not used to prose. I'm so used to scripts now, and I find them so much easier than prose. It was a real, I say a struggle. I think it's just that psychological thing of the word count. It's just,
yeah.
And knowing that every single word you put down has to be just right, and people are going to see it. It really sort of freaked me out. So I'm not sure I will ever come back to it. I mean, I'm still quite close to,
yeah,
to the whole process. So maybe in a year or so I'll forget.
As a writer, do you ever stop rewriting? I mean, how good are you at just being like, right, yeah, that's done, and I'm good?
Oh, never. You absolutely never do. even now, I was talking about something else entirely, and I suddenly just thought, oh no, have I done? And I went back and had a look at the book, and there's a bit in one of the chapters that sort of repeats the end of the previous chapter in a slightly different way. And maybe nobody will notice, but it just feels like, oh, if I could just go and it's only a few lines. If I just tweaked a few lines, then that wouldn't be an issue, but it's there now. And that's just tough luck. So yeah, I don't think you ever do. There's always things that you look back on, and especially when they're finished, and you think, oh, I didn't quite get that. Less so with the TV episode, because that's a massive team of people all working together. So, you know, I was a very small cog in that. So basically everyone else did an amazing job. So there's less for me to pick holes in. But when it's just your words on the page, then yeah, you do start thinking, oh, I could have done that better. But you know, you could just keep editing it forever and never finish it.
Oh, before I forget, I should tell you, you are responsible for my friend meeting his wife. They were both extras on Cockneys versus Zombies.
Oh,
both
wow.
Played zombies, and they met at a zombie school. So
no way.
You've inspired a wedding.
Which zombies did they play?
They're outside a block of flats. I think Michelle Ryan runs in the block of flats, and the door closes and you see them. My friend's got a ponytail. We did at the time. His name's Adam. And
it's probably the care home.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. I do say this all the time, is that I just inspire love.
What was it like working on Cockneys versus Zombies? Cause that's such a fun film.
Oh, it's as much fun as you would imagine. It was ridiculous fun. Yeah. Cause I came in when they want me to write it. I came in and just I'd written up a load of stuff because I was so excited. And I said, look, if I'm going to the cinema on a Friday night and I'm trying to decide what to see, and I look up and there's a film called Cockneys versus Zombies, and I put my 10 quid, 11 quid down to go and see that, then there are certain things I expect to see. I'll probably have had a couple of drinks, but there are certain things that I will expect to see in a film called that. And I'd written a ton of stuff in a notepad, and I just read it all out and kind of thought, ooh, is that a bit too much? And they went, no, that's great. Let's put all that in. When you write things, sort of 20 to 30% of all the fun stuff you want to get in event makes it to the screen.
Yeah.
Unaltered. And so I just went way overboard. I thought, I'm going to put so much stuff in this that even if they take out 80% of it, there'll still be a huge amount of ridiculous stuff in there. And it's pretty much all in there except for one scene that they just couldn't quite manage to pull off, because it would have been way too expensive. But everything else is in there, like some ridiculous stuff I can't believe we got away with. So that was huge fun. It didn't change that much. I did a few drafts. I think I deleted a couple of characters who weren't sort of really required. And yeah, we just kept adding stuff. There was just loads more fun stuff. And then the shooting was fun. All those amazing actors, getting to see all the zombie action. I was in it as a zombie. I was cut out, obviously, because everyone was threatened by how talented I was. And
well, they can't have that.
Well, no, I'm in it as a bank customer, and then I was also in it as a zombie later, but they cut the zombie out. But to be fair, they've got a million zombies in there. So and I got to play around being a zombie, so I don't really care.
This is why we need the novelization, so you can expand on this.
bank customer and his odyssey. Yeah, it was huge fun, and then getting to see the edit, and then just seeing it kind of get better and better the more they kind of refined it and fine tuned it and did the effects, the music, and then just the icing on the cake was that we tried to get Chaz and Dave in it, but they were touring every single day nonstop, like all year. We just couldn't get them in. They're the busiest band in the world. So that's why we got sort of the tribute band in there in the care home. And they said, would you like us to write a song for the film? And they wrote a song for the end credits. And it's my favorite type of song in a movie. It's an end credits plot song, where they just basically tell you what's happened in the film you've just watched. Oh, and that's my favorite type of movie song genre. I love it. So there's an original Chaz and Dave song on the end credits, and I could not have been happier. It was just everything I wanted it to be.
That's fantastic. And I have to say, Severance is one of my favorite kind of horror movies of all time. What was that like?
That was bonkers, because that was my first produced film script. I'd had a short film made, but this was a whole different kettle of fish, because you sort of turn up on set and there's 85 people and a massive ton of equipment all sort of working and filming this ridiculous thing that you sat and wrote in your living room for a year, never thinking it would get made. That was a very, very odd experience to have my first proper film be like that. And then when I got to set, there were two characters they hadn't cast until last, so I hadn't seen. I'd been watching the casting tapes, but obviously because they were so late in the day, I didn't see theirs. So when I got on set, they were in the middle of shooting a scene, so I looked at the monitor and saw everyone in character in their costume filming a scene. So it was just like they just pulled the characters out of the script and plopped them in front of me. It was so bizarre. I had to go off and have a little sit down and a cry, actually, on the first day, because I couldn't quite believe how amazing this was. And I'll never forget that. It's such an amazing experience and a privilege having something of yours filmed and made, because it's such a lot of work and everyone just puts their all into it. So that
must be incredible.
It was absolutely mad, and I still can't quite believe that happened either. Anytime I get anything made, I can never quite believe it, because it is such a rarity, especially in this industry, because it's just, it's a tough industry and the budgets just aren't there. So anytime something does get made, it's a little miracle.
Yeah. What was it like working on Torchwood? I mean, is the atmosphere on set any different to, say, Doctor?
Pretty similar, I would think, because there were similar teams at the top, so the attitude was very much the same from the top down, and it was just all very lovely and inclusive and friendly, and just lots of laughs and lots of farting. several of the main cast, I won't name, like to do big farts and then sneak in a big group. It was just and again, it was so strange. It was my first TV episode that got filmed, so just being on set and as they're setting off these massive explosions and everyone's running around swearing and shooting guns and it was quite bizarre. I discovered I had a knack for any time I tried to sit down, I would always be right in the middle of a shot or right in front of the camera, or just in the way of a cable or someone lifting a heavy item that needed to get past. So that's my superpower. I still do that now.
Always
in the way. But yeah, that was quite a strange experience. Because as they were filming, I already had the Doctor Who job, it was just a really weird time, because I was like, my first job is on this crazy huge show, and then my second ever TV job is on the biggest show in the country for a TV show I've been watching since I was a kid, and it's been literally my childhood dream for my second TV job, and it's all downhill from here.
I should ask, did you have a favorite Target novelization growing up?
The one I read most often was The Abominable Snowman. Because I must have owned it to read it that many times. I must have owned a copy, because I used to get them from the library and secondhand shops. Very rarely bought them new, because who had the money for that? Because there were so many of them. I don't know why that one. I think just the atmosphere, and it was because it was such an older doctor to the one I was watching. I grew up watching Tom Baker.
Yeah.
So it was only two doctors ago. It's not like it was a million years ago, but it was such a different era. So maybe that sort of felt more exotic. And it was, I didn't know at the time, it was a story that I would never, ever get to see because it doesn't exist anymore on tape. So maybe I subconsciously knew. But yeah, I read that one over and over again so many times. I just loved it. Just the atmosphere and the monsters and the characters. And it was just so interesting. What else? Obviously, anything with the Dalek on the cover, I would immediately get, because the budgets were so much bigger in the Target books than the TV show.
Yeah.
So they could do really, really huge sequences and just go to town, and just be reading it. I don't remember that in the episode.
That's what I love about Big Finish and the audio landscape, and that they can do that type of thing. James, I'm very conscious of the time because I know you're very busy today. So I'm going to thank you for joining me.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
Okay, so how great was that? I would just like to thank James for being so generous with his time and to BBC Books for arranging that interview. The Fires of Pompeii is released on the 14th of July, along with The Eaters of Light, The Stones of Blood, and The Androids of Tara.